I think we're ready to kick off today's session. Today's speakers are Kathy Davis with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Region 3 office and Rob Greenwald from Geotrans. Kathy is a hydrogeologist in our Superfund program in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She has over 20 years of experience with hydrogeologic investigations, groundwater contaminant fate and transport evaluations, and the design, implementation, and performance assessment of groundwater cleanups. Rob has more than 20 years of experience in optimization of groundwater extraction and treatment systems, capture zone evaluation, numerical modeling, hydrogeologic evaluations, and project management. He's the primary author of a recently published EPA document on capture zone evaluation for pump and treat systems, and he's presented short courses on this topic in all of our EPA regional offices, as well as some state agencies. He's also co-managed a nationwide optimization project for groundwater pump and treat systems using the remediation systems evaluation process and has participated in over 50 RSEs at Superfund, DOE, RECRA, and underground storage tank sites. At this time, I'm going to place everyone on mute, and I will ask my presenters to please unmute by hitting #6.
The leader has muted your line.
Okay, do we have Rob and Kathy back?
Rob's here. Can you hear me, Linda?
I can hear Rob. Do we have Kathy on the phone?
I'm on, Linda. Can you hear me?
Yes. So we're ready to start when you are, Kathy.
Linda, just before you do that, somebody posted something saying they were having trouble with the audio, so I don't know if the EMS person can try and contact them.
Okay, well, they should be monitoring the messages, and so they should be contacting that person directly.
Great, thank you.
Okay. If you would please move to slide 2. Hydraulic containment of contaminated groundwater, or plume capture, is one of the main objectives of a pump and treat system. Hydraulic containment can be used to control the leading edge of the plume to protect actual or potential receptors, and to prevent the continued migration of contamination in the aquifer. It can also be used to control groundwater in contact with the source area. As part of the Superfund remedy reforms, EPA committed to optimize fund lead pump and treat systems across the country. Each system was analyzed by a formal process called a remediation system evaluation, which considered both the extraction and treatment components of the systems. One of the most prevalent recommendations identified during the RSEs was to improve capture zone analysis. Please move to slide 3. A variety of issues involving capture zone analysis were identified during the RSEs. These issues included inadequate target capture zone definition, especially in 3 dimensions, not updating the model with operating information, relying on water elevations measured in the extraction wells when interpreting water levels, confusing drawdown with capture, and collecting inadequate or inappropriate data for analysis. Next slide, please. Regional EPA hydrogeologists who worked together as a group called the Groundwater Forum identified the need to develop a systematic approach to evaluating capture zones at pump and treat systems. The Groundwater Forum, along with EPA's Office of Research and Development and headquarters, collaborated on the production of a document for capture zone evaluation. The document was published in January 2008. Classroom-style training has been conducted in EPA's regional offices, at national project manager meetings, and in several states. The final training effort is today's internet course, which is being offered for the 4th time today. Next slide, please. Slide 5. This slide lists 3 reference documents. The first bullet presents the title and web address for the recently published capture zone document. The second 2 documents are by EPA and are still relevant and have been included for you for easy access. One of the primary authors of the capture zone document, as well as the main instructor for the classroom training, is Rob Greenwald, who is today's seminar training. Rob will continue the presentation with the next slide.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm moving on to slide number 6, which is a very brief outline slide. What we're going to be talking about over the next several hours is what is a capture zone? Why do we evaluate capture zones? That will be just a few slides to start off, and then we'll get into the meat of the topic, which is a systematic approach to capture zone evaluation, which focuses on six basic steps, and we'll use a series of examples and schematic figures to illustrate what is done within those six steps and what are some of the pitfalls that you have to avoid. There's a note at the bottom of slide six that indicates we're discussing systems that behave like a porous media. We're not addressing some of the added complexities of things like karst systems or fracture flow systems. That's not to say that many of the things we'll be discussing don't apply to karst or fracture flow systems. It's just those systems have some added complexities that are not addressed in this presentation or in the guidance document that's been recently published. Moving on to slide number seven, the recently published document on capture zone evaluation does contain a good bit more detail than what we'll be covering in this two-hour seminar. It's a fairly lengthy document. It has a large number of schematics. It has five case study sites that it's built around. Three of those sites are hypothetical sites. Two of those sites were real-world case studies. And those five sites are intended to illustrate a wide range of situations, and we'll only be touching on some of those in this seminar. So we're simply encouraging you with this slide to, after this presentation, take the next step, download the actual document and refer to that because it has some additional information in it. Moving on to slide number eight. It's taken us eight slides to get to this issue, which is what exactly is a capture zone? A capture zone refers to the three-dimensional region that contributes to groundwater extracted by one or more wells or drains. And we use the word capture zone interchangeably with the words hydraulic containment. The hydraulic part of that is important. You can have a groundwater remedy that's based around quote-unquote containment that, for instance, might have a permeable reactive barrier wall where water flows through that wall and concentrations are knocked down, and that provides a form of containment. But that is not a capture zone because that's not hydraulic containment. Hydraulic containment means the actual groundwater is captured by wells or drains and flows to those points of discharge. If we move on to slide number nine, this is a graphical illustration of what we mean by a capture zone in map view and in cross-section view. A map view is provided at the top and a cross-section view is provided at the bottom. Let's look at the top figure first. In this figure, you'll see a pumping well in the middle that's represented by a green circle. And you see groundwater level contours, which are labeled 988, 986, 984, et cetera. So flow is generally from right to left across the page. And then there's some roughly horizontal lines with arrows at the end of them, and those would be groundwater flow lines, which in most systems, groundwater flow lines are perpendicular to the groundwater level contours. And that's what's illustrated here. And you'll notice that a series of those groundwater flow lines end up at the pumping well, and those are the ones that are within the green shaded region. So that green shaded region represents the capture zone. It's the zone of water that's captured by the well. Other flow lines that are not captured, you can see towards the left-hand side of the figure, those are flow lines that are outside the capture zone of the well. If we look at the cross-sectional view at the bottom of this slide, one feature to note here is we've illustrated a pumping well as a partially penetrating extraction well. And we've done that to illustrate a general property regarding three-dimensionality of a capture zone. Here you'll notice that the green shaded area, which represents the capture zone of the well, does not necessarily extend the entire thickness of this aquifer because of the partially penetrating nature of the well. And as a general rule, the depth to which that capture zone will extend is a function of the vertical anisotropy, which is the ratio of the horizontal hydraulic conductivity to the vertical hydraulic conductivity. The greater the anisotropy, the harder it is for water to be captured from down deep, and the shallower the capture zone will be. The less vertical anisotropy you have, meaning the more similar the horizontal and vertical hydraulic conductivities are, then the greater the depth of capture will be. The general point on this slide is simply that with a partially penetrating well, the capture zone may not extend the entire thickness of the aquifer. move on to slide number 10. This slide introduces two important concepts, the concept of the target capture zone and the concept of an actual capture zone. The target capture zone, which we'll discuss in more detail in a little bit, that's the area that we're trying to capture. The actual capture zone is something we're interpreting. We're operating a pump and treat system, and we're pumping some wells or removing water from some drains, and we are interpreting what our actual capture is. And then the capture zone analysis is the process of first determining a target capture zone, then interpreting the actual capture zone, and comparing the two to see if we have successful capture. I'm going to move on to slide number 11. This is just some introductory information about things to consider before you do a capture zone analysis. And one of the things that was observed in some of those remediation system evaluations that Kathy mentioned was that a pump and treat system had been designed, it was then built, and in many cases there were aspects of the pump and treat system as operating that differed from the system that was originally designed. And some of the ways it may differ are listed on this slide. Clearly, the extraction well locations or rates may differ from what was designed. Sometimes the well locations differ for something as simple as, you know, the person who designed the system back in the office didn't realize they'd located a well in the middle of a house or on a property that there's no legal access to, things like that. Many times the well rates will be less than anticipated because of geologic heterogeneities or because well inefficiencies are such that the well doesn't produce what you thought it was going to produce. There's other factors that lead to changes from the design that are listed at the bottom of the slide. System downtime, there might be issues inside the treatment plant that cause the pumping system to not operate as intended. There may be time-varying influences that were not fully considered during the design process. In some cases, you have seasons, like a wet season and a dry season, or an irrigation season and a non-irrigation season. At other sites, you may have tidal influences. You may have a high tide and a low tide condition over the course of a day. You may have a case where a new water supply well is added off-site that wasn't there when the system was designed but is there now, for instance. Well fouling is another issue that can cause declining well yields over time. And again, many designs are done based on fairly simple models that may not account for all the high hydrogeologic heterogeneity that might exist, such as zones of higher hydraulic connectivity. Now I'm going to move on to slide number 12. This slide is intended to get across the concept of why we need to do good capture zone evaluations, what it is we're trying to avoid. If we look at the picture on this slide, at the right-hand side of the slide, we have a plume that's in various shades of green. We've got a target capture zone, which is a bold blue line. And then we have three pumping wells illustrated with gray circles. And the intent, obviously, is for those extraction wells to create an adequate zone of capture. But what's illustrated on this slide with the black envelopes or the black lines are the actual capture zones. And in this case, the actual capture zones from the three pumping wells leave the gap in capture such that the plume can continue to grow and potentially impact the downgradient receptor. And obviously, this is what we're trying to avoid. It can obviously compromise the protectiveness with respect to that receptor. And just the fact that the plume is allowed to continue to grow can cause a situation many people call chasing after the plume, where you end up adding new monitoring wells or perhaps having to extend an extraction system off-site, which increases the cost. It can increase the time to clean up. It can create many administrative and access headaches. And obviously, it's inefficient. So that's what we're trying to avoid. Moving on to slide number 13, this slide introduces the six basic steps that comprise the systematic approach to capture zone evaluation. We're going to go through each of these six steps in detail over the course of this seminar. So here we'll just introduce the steps so you get a feel for the overall flow of it. Step number one and step number two are what we would call preliminary steps. They're reviewing site data, the site conceptual model, reviewing the remedy objectives, and defining the target capture zone. steps 3, 4, and 5 are the interpretive steps. Those are the steps where we're trying to interpret the actual capture zone. Step 3 is all about water levels. Step 4 is all about performing calculations. And step 5 is about evaluating trends in water quality data. And then step 6 is where it's all brought together. The target capture zone and the actual capture zone are compared. Uncertainties are assessed, recommendations are made, etc. At the bottom of this slide, the concept of converging lines of evidence is introduced. And let's move on to slide number 14, where we talk a little bit more about converging lines of evidence. The concept here is that when performing a capture zone evaluation, there is usually no definitive line of evidence. What we usually say is if any one line of evidence, such as looking at a water level map, makes it so clear that you have effective capture, you're probably pumping more water than you need to. If you're not pumping more water than you need to, oftentimes the capture zone evaluation can be somewhat ambiguous when you look at any one piece of evidence, any one calculation, any one water level map, etc. Therefore, we like to try and build multiple lines of evidence. We like to have evidence based on calculations. We like to have evidence based on water levels. We like to have evidence, if possible, based on water quality trends, and use multiple lines of evidence. And it's very much like circumstantial evidence in a murder lawsuit, or you don't have a smoking gun, but you're trying to build as many different lines of evidence as possible so that at the end of the day you have as much confidence in your conclusions as possible. So you'll see as we go through the presentation examples of converging lines of evidence. Moving on to slide number 15, we added a flowchart to the presentation because we were told every presentation needs to have a flowchart. In this particular flowchart, I'd like to highlight the diamonds, which represent key questions during the capture zone process. The first diamond says, after we do a capture zone evaluation with our existing data, the question being asked is, are there data gaps that make the conclusion of capture uncertain? And the important thing to note here is the question does not say, are there uncertainties? Because if that was the question, are there uncertainties, the answer would always be yes. There will always be uncertainties when you're dealing with hydrogeologic systems because we just can't know everything there is to know. The real question is what's posed here. Are those data gaps such that they make our overall conclusion uncertain? If that's the case, then there's a need to fill in the data gaps. However, if we feel confident in our conclusions, because although we have some uncertainties, we have so many multiple lines of evidence that we feel okay, then we go to the second diamond below, which is capture successful based on comparing the target capture zone and the interpreted capture zone? If capture is not determined to be successful, there's clearly a need to optimize extraction. This might mean adding new extraction wells. This might mean increasing pumping rates, or it might mean adding injection wells or perhaps a slurry wall or sheet piling or something to enhance the capture. If capture is determined to be successful, obviously there's a need to continue monitoring, but there might be opportunities also to reduce costs by, again, eliminating extraction wells or lowering pumping rates. So those are all things that need to be considered as part of a capture zone evaluation. So moving on to slide number 16, that is a basic introduction. And at this point, we have the first of three question and answer periods that we'll have during the seminar just to see if anyone has any questions that have arisen based on this introductory material.
Thanks, Rob. If you would like to ask a question, you can hit #6 to unmute your phone. We don't have any questions from the simulcast folks. Is there anyone on the phone that has a question for Kathy or Rob? And that's #6 to unmute your phone. Okay.
Fair enough. We'll move on to slide number 17, which is an introductory slide that indicates what we'll now be focusing our attention on is the details of the 6 steps that comprise this systematic approach. So I'm going to move on to slide number 18, and we'll start talking about step number 1, which is to review site data, the site conceptual model, and the remedy objectives. And one of the key things to consider in step number one is the adequacy of the plume delineation. Is the plume adequately delineated in three dimensions? This is obviously critical because it's very difficult to do step number two, which is establish a target capture zone, if we don't really know how big the plume is. Now, it may be the case that we don't know how big the entire plume is as part of an interim remedy, in which case we at least need to know, is the source area or the most critical area adequately delineated, so we can design an interim remedy that involves hydraulic containment of the source area. But it's the same basic concept. It's important to know if the plume is adequately delineated. And again, three dimensions is a critical part of that. Capture zone is inherently a three-dimensional analysis. As we'll discuss later, there are times when it will reduce down to a two-dimensional problem. But that third dimension always has to be considered. Have we considered the potential for vertical transport, and have we delineated our plume three-dimensionally? Listed on the bottom of slide number 18 are some other basic pieces of hydrogeologic information that we would like to have some information about when we're going to do a capture zone evaluation. It's very important, obviously, to know something about the hydraulic conductivity values and whether those are uniformly distributed or non-uniformly distributed over space. We get hydraulic conductivity information a number of different ways. You can get it from as simply as estimating it based on the type of material using a textbook like Freeze and Cherry. We can get it from regional hydrogeologic reports from, for instance, the U.S. Geological Survey. You can get it from pump tests. You can get it from model calibration. You can get it from flood tests. Generally, a pump test would be considered by most people to be the sort of the best piece of data compared to something like a slug test, because a pump test is a more aerially distributed test rather than focusing right in the vicinity in the construction of the well itself, assuming you're doing the pump test with observation wells besides the pumping well. You obviously also want to know something about the hydraulic gradient. And recognize a gradient as a vector that has both a magnitude and a direction. So you want to know how steep that hydraulic gradient is, and you want to know what direction groundwater flows in and whether that changes either over space or over time. You want to know something about the aquifer thickness or the saturated thickness so you can do some of the calculations that we'll talk about. You obviously need to know something about the pumping rates and the pumping locations, especially if you want to do something like make a groundwater flow model. You're going to need to have groundwater elevation measurements for almost any aspect of this. You're going to want to make water level maps. You're going to need water level elevations for that. And for many of the calculations, that's how you're going to determine what the hydraulic gradient is, what the flow directions are, et cetera. Water quality data over time, obviously, if we're going to have step five, which is all about water quality trends, we're going to need some water quality data to evaluate that line of evidence. And well construction data refers to things like the XY coordinates of the monitoring wells, the screen intervals of the monitoring wells, so we can determine which wells are screened in one aquifer versus another aquifer, etc. Moving on to slide number 19. Another aspect of step number one is to determine whether there is an adequate site conceptual model. Some people call that a conceptual site model instead of a site conceptual model. They basically mean the same thing. This is not a numerical model like ModFlow or anything. It's not that at all. A site conceptual model is a description using text, using figures, etc., that try to explain the water system. Where does groundwater flow? Where are the sources and sinks of the water? Where did the contaminants come from, and where are they going, and how fast are the contaminants being transported based on the properties of the groundwater flow and the properties of the contaminants? Where are the receptors? How sensitive are those receptors to the groundwater contamination risks? Those types of things are part of the site conceptual model. And again, there will always be some uncertainties in the site conceptual model. It's something that evolves over time as you get more information about a site. But these types of basic questions should be able to be answered. If they can't, it's a big red flag in terms of doing a capture zone evaluation if you can't answer some of these basic questions to some degree of certainty. Moving on to slide number 20. Another important part of step number one is to review the remedy objectives, and specifically we're talking about the remedy objectives as they relate to hydraulic containment. At many sites, the remedy objectives that might be stated in, say, a decision document might be a little vague. You might say, well, the objective is to contain the plume and clean up the plume. You know, that's kind of vague. It doesn't really provide the prioritization. Maybe a more clearly stated remedy objective would be, our initial, most time-sensitive objective is to hydraulically contain the most contaminated portion of the plume as defined by something. A secondary objective is to remediate the downgrading portion of the plume with some other technology to clean up levels. And then the third, you know, step is to clean up the source area using such and such an approach. That would be a more clearly stated remedy objective with regards to hydraulic containment. Perhaps more specifically, hydraulic containment is sort of managed several different ways. In some cases, the plume is, or the system is managed to provide complete hydraulic containment of the entire plume, whereas in other cases, it's only hydraulic containment of a portion of the plume, where the remains using some other technology. And we have a few schematics to illustrate this point. So moving on to slide number 21, this slide has a graphic on the top and a graphic on the bottom. These are both map views. In this case, let's look at the top figure first. We've got a plume in different shades of green and blue. And we've drawn a conceptual capture zone in black. And in this particular case, that conceptual capture zone surrounds basically the entire plume. And what we're representing here is this would be a graphical way to illustrate a goal of a complete hydraulic containment, at least in the horizontal flow direction. Whereas the slide at the bottom, which is also a map view, is illustrating something altogether different, where the conceptual capture zone is being drawn around the most impacted part of the plume, and there is some other portion of the plume which is being left uncaptured and presumably is being addressed by some other technology. Perhaps that's monitored natural attenuation, or perhaps it's some other active remedial technology. So both of these are possible, and it's important to understand which one you're dealing with for your particular system. If we move on to slide number 22, this is essentially illustrating the same concept, just looking in the vertical direction rather than the horizontal direction. So in this case, we're looking at cross-sectional views. Looking at the top of the figure first, what you'll see is a plume in green, and that is in the shallow aquifer. And below that, we have a semi-confining unit, and then we have a deeper aquifer. And if you'll notice, as you look towards the left-hand side of the figure, there's a public water supply well that is screened in the deeper aquifer. So we have a three-dimensional problem here. The plume is restricted at this point to the shallow aquifer. And the top figure here is indicating a situation where the goal of the pumitrete remedy is to hydraulically contain the plume horizontally and vertically. The horizontally is based on the big arrow that is pointed towards the right, the big red arrow, and the vertical hydraulic containment is being represented conceptually by these three vertical arrows pointing up, which suggest that we need to have an upward hydraulic gradient to create this hydraulic containment of the plume in the vertical direction. A different way to manage this plume might be illustrated on the bottom, where we have the same setup. We have the plume in the shallow aquifer. We have the receptor in the deep aquifer. In this case, there's only a big red arrow pointing to the right, indicating horizontal hydraulic containment, meaning this particular plume is being managed in such a way that we don't want the plume to spread horizontally. The vertical is being addressed with some other manner. In other words, there might be monitoring in the deeper aquifer to ensure that there's adequate attenuation of contamination. So MNA, for instance, might be the remedy in the deeper aquifer, or the deeper aquifer may be below cleanup levels. In this particular case, there is no goal of vertical hydraulic containment. There's some other form of technology being applied for the deeper aquifer. So again, it's important to know which of these two situations are being managed before you do your capture zone evaluation. Now I'm going to move on to slide number 23. which begins our discussion about step number two, defining the target capture zone. So again, step number one is all about putting together some preliminary information. Do we understand the hydrogeology? Do we understand the site conceptual model? Where the contaminants came from, where they're going to, where the receptors are, and what are our remedy goals? Presumably, once we have done all of that work in step one, step number two will generally be quite easy. It'll generally fall right out of all that work that's been done in step one. Where specifically is hydraulic capture required? And that question needs to be asked with respect to horizontal flow, with respect to vertical flow, and any other conditions that might be of a political or legal, that might be oriented politically or legally, any other conditions. The target capture zone should be consistent with the remedy objectives laid out in step number one. Whenever possible, the target capture zone should be illustrated on maps and cross sections. It's also important to note that the target capture zone could be almost an arbitrary line. For instance, it could just be a site boundary. We don't want the plume to go beyond this site boundary, or we don't want the plume to go beyond this road because we don't have access on the other side of the road, so we don't want the plume to go that far. In many other cases, the target capture zone may be based on concentration contours, such as we want to capture the 5 part per billion TCE contour because that's the MCL. Or if we're doing an interim remedy, it might be something like we want to capture the 100 part per billion or the 1,000 part per billion TCE contour of the most impacted area as part of this interim remedy. It's important to note, though, if it's being based on the shape of the plume, which is in turn being based on concentration contours, it's just important to remember that those concentration contours may change over time, and they are maybe based on more than one constituent. A lot of times, reports at a site highlight one or two key constituents, but there are other constituents at times, and it's important to look at the footprint of all those constituents when determining the target capture zone in that manner. As I mentioned, concentration contours may change over time for reasons such as adding new monitoring wells, or because of the pump and treat system itself, or because of new sources of contamination being added to the plume, or the original source of the plume being remediated by some other technology. There's all kinds of reasons of why these concentration contours change over time. So that just needs to be considered, and the target capture zone may need to be periodically updated. Moving on to slide number 24, this just shows schematically how a target capture zone might be illustrated on a map on the top and on a cross-section on the bottom. In this particular case, looking at the map view on the top, the target capture zone is containing the entire plume. And on the bottom, which is a cross-sectional view, similar to what we were looking at before, in this case, the target capture zone, there's a horizontal component and a vertical component. The vertical component is implied by the horizontal line that's running across the top of the semi-confining unit. By indicating that that's part of the target capture zone, there's an implication that there is a goal to have an upward hydraulic gradient from the deeper aquifer to the shallow aquifer in this particular case. Now I'm moving on to slide number 25, where we're going to start talking about step number three, which is the interpretation of water levels. So as I mentioned earlier, steps one and two are what I would call the precursor steps. Steps 3, 4, and 5 are what I would call the interpretive steps, where we're doing the actual analysis of capture, trying to determine how big our capture zone really is. So first we'll talk about step 3, which is all about water levels. And water levels can be looked at in quite a few different ways, which are summarized on slide number 25. We can make potentiometric surface maps. Here we're using the word, just to be simple, just to keep things simple, potentiometric surface map is the same thing as a water level map. We mean the same thing by those terms for the purposes of this discussion. When we make a water level map, we can interpret flow directions, and based on those flow lines, we can try to interpret the extent of capture. And that generally is used to evaluate the horizontal capture zone. We can also make head difference maps between aquifers. That can allow us to try to figure out where water is flowing upwards and where water is flowing downwards. And finally, we can look at water levels at specific pairs of wells to see if the water level is greater at one point versus another nearby point to try and interpret whether water is flowing in one direction or the other. In other words, if we have a site boundary and we have two wells straddling that site boundary and the head outside is higher than the head inside, then the groundwater is interpreted to flow inward relative to the site boundary and vice versa. Similarly, at a river, if we know the stage in the river and we know the head in the aquifer adjacent to the river, if the head in the aquifer is higher than the stage of the river, then water is flowing from the aquifer to the river. But if the stage in the river is higher than in the aquifer, water is flowing from the river into the aquifer. And that's the way we use these water level pairs. We can also use water level pairs vertically to look at specific clusters of monitoring wells where the where we have a well in a shallow aquifer and then a deep aquifer, and we can look at the relative water levels between those two aquifers to determine if at that location flow is upward or downward. I'm moving on to slide number 26. This slide presents some information to keep in mind when looking at water levels. The first note is that installing water level measurement points at most, not all, but at most sites is relatively inexpensive. The cost of drilling a piezometer in my part of the country, which is New Jersey, and into a shallow aquifer that's say 15 or 25 feet deep, you can install these things for several thousand dollars a piece. Now in the material we present here, we differentiate, we use a terminology to differentiate between a piezometer and a monitor well. And we use the term piezometer to represent a point where we're only going to measure water levels, whereas a monitor well is a point where we're going to measure water levels and water quality. And it's an important distinction because at many sites, a responsible party may be very hesitant to add a new monitoring well into the ground, not because it costs a lot to drill it, but because it costs a lot to sample water quality at that well, say quarterly or semi-annually, for an indefinite period of time. So if we stipulate that a certain point is going to be added just for the purpose of measuring water levels, that can make a big difference in terms of the overall tone of the discussion. Another note about water levels is, well, I should point out that while piezometers are inexpensive at most sites, they can be quite expensive at some sites. Those would be sites, for instance, where the water level is quite deep, so you have to drill a piezometer hundreds and hundreds of feet. It could also be expensive at, say, a nuclear facility where, you know, special conditions occur that make drilling of anything very, very expensive. So there are obviously some cases where simply drilling a piezometer is still quite expensive. The next note on this slide is that it's really nice when the people taking the water levels have some knowledge about what the expected depth to water should be at each point. The people who are out in the field, that's what they're collecting. They're collecting a depth to water. Back in the office is generally where that depth to water is being converted into a water level elevation based on the top of casing elevation. What happens sometimes is the person in the field collects the depth to water, gets the data back to the office. A few days later, somebody in the office is analyzing it and says, well, geez, this doesn't make any sense. Well, it's too late now. The person's already not in the field anymore, and even if they were still in the field, it's several days or weeks later, and you can't really replace that water level measurement. So what is better is if the person in the field has some table to indicate what the depth to water is expected to be based on historical measurements or any other expectation. That way, if there's an out-of-the-norm value, they can call back to the office and say, I have this out-of-the-norm value. How should I address this? So it can be addressed right then and there in the field. Another note on this slide, slide number 26, is that performing periodic well surveys is recommended. By periodic well surveys, we're talking about here about surveying the horizontal coordinates, but more importantly, the vertical elevations of the top of casing so that we can get accurate water level measurements from the depth to waters. Frequently, when wells are installed at a site, they're installed over a course of many years by different contractors, by different drillers. They're surveyed by different surveyors, and it can lead to erroneous water level elevations, especially where the groundwater table is relatively flat. So what we're recommending is that not every year, but perhaps every 5 years or so, a survey be done of all the existing monitoring wells so that they're all being measured on a consistent basis. Moving on to slide number 27. moving on to slide number 27. Just another note about making water level maps is that contouring can be done by hand, or contouring can be done with a software package such as Surfer or any other number of contouring algorithms. Some people use a combination of the two. The advantage of contouring water levels by hand is that it incorporates the insight of the hydrogeologist. The hydrogeologist has certain pieces of information that they can take into account, such as the shape of the plume, or the location of a pond, or the way groundwater contours would tend to V when they hit a surface water body. Software, on the other hand, allows operations to be repeated, and also allows pretty pictures. You can make things like the vector map illustrated on the right. Just have it up there just to make the point that a software product can easily generate these vectors where the arrows show the direction of the groundwater flow, and maybe the length of the arrow illustrates the magnitude of the hydraulic gradient. So that's kind of nice. One way to look at variability in contouring is, if you're doing it by hand, have two different or three different people try to contour the same data, see how similar or different they are. If they're very different, try and figure out what's driving that difference and whether that is a key uncertainty that needs to be addressed. And if you're doing it with software, there are multiple algorithms to try. So you can try multiple algorithms. Try kriging, try inverse distance to multiple parameters. There's all different kinds of contouring algorithms, and you can try different ones and see how similar or different they are. Again, if you have very different results, that might point out some uncertainties in your data, presumably because you have very sparse data in those cases. Another thing is that if you're using computer software, you can consider taking your actual data and then helping the contouring along in the software by adding what we would call pseudo data points or control points, where you're actually adding data at specific locations to add in some of this insight that you might have as a hydrogeologist. The only thing I would caution is that if you take that approach, you should identify that you're doing so. Either provide a list of the data that you added, or at least a notation in your text that you did add data to condition the results of the actual data. Moving on to slide number 28. This slide points out perhaps one of the most important issues that we'll talk about during this seminar, which is the use of water levels at pumping wells for making water level maps. The schematic in the center of this figure illustrates the point. Here we have a pumping well, and there's a big red arrow coming out of the pumping well that's representing the water. That's the extraction rate of the well. We have a screen interval of the pumping well, and right next to the pumping well there's a piezometer, and that's labeled piezometer near the ground surface. So we have this piezometer that's maybe 5, 10, 15 feet away from our pumping well. The upside down triangles represent the water level, and what you'll notice is that the water level inside the pumping well is significantly lower than the water level measured in the piezometer, which is just beyond the pumping well. And this is a very common occurrence, and it's referred to different ways by different people, but we will here just call it a combination of well inefficiencies and well losses. And these well inefficiencies and well losses are caused by a number of things. They're caused by poor or inadequate development of the well, caused by well fouling, it's caused by turbulent flow across the well screen. It's caused by a whole number of factors that make it difficult for the water in the aquifer to effectively get into the well. And as a result, it causes more drawdown inside the well than is observed in the immediate vicinity in the aquifer. Why this causes problems is, if you don't have that piezometer there and you simply measure the water level in that pumping well, it's an artificially low value in most cases. And in some cases, I've observed, as a professional, I've seen those well losses be as much as 10 feet and even as much as 100 feet in some wells. So the water level in the well might be as much as, in some sites, 100 feet lower than in the aquifer immediately adjacent, and that's very significant. So we highly recommend that you try to have a water level measurement point, such as a piezometer, located near each pumping well whenever possible. If we move to slide number 29, this next couple of slides is going to illustrate why this is important. On slide number 29, we have a plume being represented with the green shaded area. And we have some interpreted water level contours, which are, you know, these concentric lines labeled 112, 114, 116, that are being interpreted based on the water levels that are posted next to each well. And what you'll notice right in the middle, one of those water level points is at EW1, which is an extraction well. And you'll notice that the water level at EW1 is much lower than at all of the other points. So what's being interpreted on this map, because they're using the water level at the extraction well, is this bullseye where all the groundwater is flowing to the extraction well, and it looks like the entire plume is being effectively captured. If we go to the next slide, which is slide number 30, this shows what might be the case if we ignored the water level at extraction well EW1 because we are suspect of it, because it is at an extraction well, and we instead install a piezometer a few feet away from the extraction well. And we measure the water level there. And as you see, the interpretation is entirely different. The water level at the piezometer does not indicate nearly as low a water level. We don't nearly have that bullseye effect. In fact, based on these sets of water levels, there's really no indication of significant capture whatsoever from this pumping well. So it just goes to show, by the way, I should say this example is loosely based on a real-world case that was observed. So this type of thing happens all the time, and if there's one thing you should carry away from this seminar, it's this issue about the importance of not using water levels at pumping wells and instead having data from actual water level measurement points near the extraction wells. Moving on to slide number 31, this slide points out some of the other general issues associated with evaluating water level maps are the number and location of measurements adequate. I think anyone would tell you they'd rather have more data than less data. As a general rule, you can certainly say that the contouring accuracy will increase as the number of data points available increases. It's impossible to simply say you need 20 points or you need 30 points. It's very site specific, but it is a general rule that the contouring accuracy increases with the number of points. We've already discussed this issue about water levels included in the vicinity of extraction wells. Has horizontal capture evaluation been performed for all pertinent horizontal units? Is there bias in the contouring algorithm? We've already discussed how you can get around that, or at least evaluate that. And is representation of transient influences adequate? And here, what we're suggesting is you need to ask some questions. I have an annual report, and in that annual report, I have a water level map. Well, is that water level map representative of that year? That's what needs to be asked. Is there a tidal condition such that I need to be concerned about high tide and low tide? Is there a seasonal impact such that I need to be concerned about perhaps different flow directions in summer versus winter, or additional pumping wells nearby that only pump in one season or another? Those questions need to be asked, and if those issues are pertinent, then perhaps multiple water level maps really need to be constructed. Moving on to slide number 32, this slide addresses an issue that Kathy raised in her introduction that was observed at some of the sites where remediation system evaluations were performed, and that was the general issue of confusing drawdown and capture, which was observed at several of the sites. Where it's manifested is people will say, I know we have good capture because at all the points I'm looking at, the pumping well causes drawdown. And when you hear something like that, your first reaction should be, well, that really doesn't help. Just because I have drawdown at a location does not mean that location is inside the capture zone. And we want to illustrate that with a series of two schematics on these next two slides. So first, looking at slide number 32, this is looking at a cross-sectional view. We have our pumping well, which is the green vertical line in the middle of the schematic. We've got what we call the static water table that slopes from right to left. The static water table represents the water table before we pump at the well. Then we have another water table, which is the resulting water table due to pumping, and that's the one that makes like a V around the pumping well. And what you'll notice is in every place on this figure, the bottom water level is lower than the static water level. And the difference between those two water levels is the drawdown caused by the pumping well. Now, what you'll notice, if we look at the left-hand side, there's a vertical dashed line. And Based on the hydraulic gradients of the resulting water table after pumping, on the right-hand side of that vertical dashed line, the groundwater flows towards the pumping well. And on the left-hand side of that vertical dashed line, the groundwater flows away from the pumping well. Now, at every location to the left of that pumping well on this figure, we do have some drawdown due to pumping. But the water is still flowing away from the pumping well. In other words, it's not inside the capture zone. And this is just indicating that at all points on the left-hand side of that vertical dashed line, we do have drawdown, but we are not inside the capture zone. And that's the point we're trying to make. The same point is illustrated on slide number 33, looking at a map. What we have here is a pumping well represented with a green symbol, and we've got our plume. We don't have a plume. We have our capture zone that's shaded in green. And we've got the cone of depression that is a series of blue concentric lines. The cone of depression, that is representing a contour of the drawdown, so the drawdown caused by pumping. And what you'll notice is that the zone of capture is not equivalent to the zone of drawdown. There's a lot of areas that are inside the blue concentric circles that are nevertheless not inside the capture zone. They're not captured by the pumping well. And the reason for the difference has to do with the background hydraulic gradient. The extent of capture results from the superposition of the drawdown caused by pumping on top of a regional hydraulic gradient. And the only time the zone of capture will be equal to the zone of drawdown will be when there is absolutely no background hydraulic gradient. And that very rarely, if ever, happens in nature. So rather what you're going to find is that your capture zone will be elongated with your flow direction, and there will be many areas where you do have drawdown, but you're outside the zone of capture. And that's what we're trying to illustrate with this figure. Moving on to slide number 34. Now we're going to have a slide about water level pairs. And what we're illustrating on this schematic figure is we have a site boundary. In this case, it's labeled AA prime, and that's represented by the line at the top of the figure. We have three pumping wells that are represented with black circles. And then we have a series of water level pair locations represented by the triangles. In each case, we have one monitoring location at the boundary and another location just inside the boundary. And the water levels are posted. And you'll see where the water level is higher at the boundary, we have an inward arrow. And where the water level is higher inside the boundary, we have an outward pointing arrow. And we wanted to point out a few things with this schematic. Number one, as a general rule, you'll notice that we have inward flow immediately down gradient of the pumping wells, but we have outward flow in between the pumping wells. Now, it's not a general rule that will happen. It is a general rule that that's the most likely place for outward flow to happen, is between the extraction wells. That's going to be the most sensitive location. Now, another thing that we're trying to point out here is we have these dashed lines on the figure, these dashed gray lines, which are representing flow lines. And what we're trying to point out is just because you have outward flow along a portion of the site boundary doesn't mean that capture de facto is a failure. As illustrated by the dashed lines here, it is possible that you can have water that flows beyond a site boundary and then curves back. The problem is you generally will not have a figure at your site that has these dashed gray lines on them. So you're going to have to interpret that, if that's the case, some other way. And the way you would determine that is by using other lines of evidence, such as a groundwater flow model, or such as water quality trends down gradient of the site that show declining concentration trends over time after the remedy was installed. Those types of other lines of evidence will help you interpret whether this is alarming or not. Obviously, to make this less alarming, another thing you could do would be to turn all of those arrows inward. And the way to do that would be to pump more, perhaps add more pumping wells, or perhaps increase the pumping rates at these extraction wells. And that sounds like a great solution. It's just there's other things you need to consider before you go ahead and implement that. And that is, pumping more water may cost a lot more money. It may not be feasible, given constraints you have in your aquifer or in your treatment plant. And it may, in fact, have damaging impacts, such as you might cause wetlands to dewater, or you might dewater a nearby well screen, say of an agricultural well or a residential well. So simply increasing the pumping rate is not always the answer. It can be the answer at some sites to help improve confidence in this particular line of evidence to make all the gradients inward. It just needs, there are other factors that need to be considered before you go down that direction. So slide number 35 just summarizes much of what we just said. Water level pairs are most likely to indicate outward flow when located between the pumping wells. Increasing the pumping rates to achieve inward gradients can increase confidence that capture is achieved, but there might be increased cost or other factors that need to be considered. And what we didn't mention yet on the last slide is you can also use these monitor well clusters to look at pairs of water levels vertically to say at this location we think flow is upward versus downward. Just recognize that at many sites we have a limited number of such clusters. So at this point, we'll have a second question and answer period. We're about a little more than halfway through the seminar content-wise. We're halfway through time-wise, so at this point we can take some questions.
Thanks, Rob. And we have a couple of questions from the simulcast listeners. The first is from Aaron Kirby with Golder Associates. He asks, if you don't have a piezometer and site conditions preclude installing one, would you recommend not using the water level in the extraction well to contour your water level surface? At the site I'm thinking of, we have other wells close by within 10 feet.
Okay, it's a good question. Firstly, if you have other wells within 10 feet, I mean, depending on you, that's probably close enough, especially if those wells clearly indicate the impacts of pumping. At other sites, let's generalize this question and say, let's say you didn't have other water level measurement points within 10 feet. The more general question is, if site conditions preclude installing piezometers, do you simply throw out the water levels at the extraction well, or do you use the water levels at the extraction well? Just using them straight up is not a great solution for the reasons we've discussed. Just throwing them out is also not a great solution because the wells do represent points of low water levels in the system. It's just how low really are they. What you can do if conditions preclude putting in piezometers, there's a number of calculations that can be performed to estimate the extent of the well losses. You can, for instance, if you think the well losses are primarily caused by turbulent flow, you can analyze them using a step drawdown test. There's methods you can use to extrapolate and assume slope of the water table towards a pumping well, both graphically or analytically, to calculate what you think the aquifer water level should be in the vicinity of the pumping well. Those are all calculations you can do. So my response to the question would be, if you can't put in a real point, you want to try to correct the measured water level in the pumping well as best you can. And there's some discussion of this in the actual guidance or in the actual published document. I would say, though, there is a strong preference that those types of calculations be avoided because they're subject to so much uncertainty and so much debate that my experience has been you will spend more money debating between the stakeholders the validity of those calculations than it will cost you to simply add the water level measurement point straight up. So hopefully that answers that question.
Thanks, Rob. We have one more question submitted online. It's from Nambach with GSHI in Dallas, Texas. Please tell me more about how to obtain head difference for vertical capture. So do we need multi-level screen wells for this purpose?
Yep, that's exactly what you need. You need, let me rephrase that. The best way to do it is to have well clusters. So whether that's one well with multiple screens that you have somehow packered off from one another. Generally what you're talking about is two monitor wells near each other that have different screens, so that I think that's what you mean by a multi-screen well, where you have a water level in one aquifer, you have a water level in another aquifer, right in a cluster. Now, that being said, it is possible to try to interpret vertical head differences by contouring water levels in one aquifer and contouring water levels in another aquifer, even though you don't have any clusters where you have, measurements in the same location. So you're basically creating a surface in the shallow aquifer, you're creating another surface in the deep aquifer, and then you can subtract those two surfaces and try to interpret upward and downward using that approach. I will say that approach is tends to be fraught with error because of the way you're extrapolating and interpolating. You can interpolate areas of upward or downward flow that don't really exist just because of the different density of data points in each of the aquifers. So you have to do that method with caution. So it's best to have clusters of water level measurement points right near each other in the two aquifers, and then you contour those differences. Hopefully that answered that question.
Thanks, Rob. Let's go to the phone lines now. Remember to hit #6 to unmute your phone and state your name and company and your question. So do we have any questions on the phone line? Okay, if you have questions on the, we have one more question on the simulcast. From Brad Tessera with Petrotech in Missoula, Montana. So if a naturally occurring vertical gradient doesn't exist, what are some typical techniques for creating one when the units are separated by semi-confining and confining layers?
Okay, I think what Bradley is asking is if there is no natural vertical gradient upward, yet we want, so let's say the, I'm not quite sure what he's asking, but let's assume what he's asking is that we want to make sure there's an upward vertical gradient, but one doesn't exist under natural conditions. How do you do that? Well, you can do it two different ways. One is through pumping in, say, the shallow aquifer, which will lower the heads in the shallow aquifer. The other is to, perhaps as is being suggested, inject water, clean water, into the deeper aquifer is another way to do it. I will say there are some sites where it's simply not possible to take a naturally occurring downward gradient and convert it into an upward gradient. It may not be possible to inject enough water, or it might not be possible to pump enough water. You might actually, you know, dewater or cause other problems before you would actually create an upward gradient. So it's not possible in every case, especially when you have high hydraulic connectivities and relatively flat hydraulic gradients.
Okay, now if you have, I'll go out one more time to the phone line. If you have a question for Rob or Kathy, please hit #6 and ask your question.
My call phone relates to you. I just a simple question. I'm curious, in looking at those piezometers around your pumping wells, if you have a preferential direction you'd want to install them, i.e., would you want to put them in general down gradient of your pumping well to estimate the point of stagnation, or does it matter?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. If you have preferential flow directions, I think you'd want to do all of the above. In other words, to interpret things, you'd probably want to have them side gradient and down gradient to try and interpret that. You know, it's difficult when you have preferential flow paths. Clearly, even just having one piezometer down gradient your pumping well, it's going to be difficult to establish the stagnation zone that way because, you know, if one of the points is your extraction well, you kind of have to throw that out. So what you would really need a series of piezometers down gradient of your extraction well to really nail down where that stagnation point is. You know, more generally, you're going to want to, you know, try to nail down that stagnation point with some form of calculation or modeling, which we'll discuss in a few minutes. So, but I would say if you're trying to get a handle on your, you know, a water level map where you have preferential flow paths, you're going to need more water level map, more water levels to do that. So you're probably going to need multiple piezometers. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Great.
Okay, do we have any more calls on the, any more questions on the phone? Hit #6.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
My name is Samar from Oswer in Washington, D.C. You talked about adding data. Just like to find out in most studies, how often do you have to do that in terms of adding data, and what do you have to I mean, you said to keep notes on it. I'm sure because the cost of investigation is often an issue in the field, how often do you have to do that, and does it really affect a lot in real-world situation, the results of pump and treat?
Well, what he's referring to is a comment I made earlier about when you're making a contour map of water levels, and if you're doing it with a computer software, it doesn't have the insight of the hydrogeologist. So, for instance, let's say you have a pond, And your conceptual model is that that pond is a source of water to the aquifer. As a hydrogeologist, if I'm going to draw that water level map, I might draw my water level contours that illustrate a mound of water near that pond, even if I don't have any water level measurements there. And the way I would, so if I was making the map by hand, I would just draw it that way. But if I'm doing it by computer and I just enter to the computer all the water level measurements I have, I don't have a water level measurement near that pond. It's never going to draw a mound of water level around the pond. So I add maybe a point or two of data that I quote-unquote make up near that. That's the kind of way you might use this. And, you know, it's very site-specific as to whether you may or may not do this. It's simply a way to make the water levels that the computer is generating, doing it the way you would do it yourself if you were drawing it by hand. So there's nothing bad about it, and all I was suggesting is if you are going to do that, that you simply indicate that you did it. You know,
I see.
To report, you might say something like, to create the mound of water near the pond, I inserted an artificial data value of 162 feet MSL. It's as simple as that.
I see. Is it only for the depth, the piezometric data, not for water quality? Another quick question. What is MNA, by the way?
MNA is monitored natural attenuation.
Okay. All right.
And, generally, I would say that maybe you could add artificial data like that for water quality map, though I would say it's much more common to be done for a water level map. Water quality map, you generally have a better delineation of the area that you're most interested in. But again, you might do it for a water level map, for water quality, and if you do, you should just say that you did it. It's nothing bad. It's not implying that there's anything bad to doing it. It's just making the software generate something that looks the way you want to draw it. Hopefully that answered that question.
Yes, it does. But have you seen any implications of that in real-world situation where that kind of scenario didn't really match with the real when they went for real remediation?
Well, again, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I've certainly seen situations where if you didn't do it, based on the water level maps you'd have, if you simply used a contouring package like Surfer to generate the water levels, they wouldn't make any sense. Because you'd say the water level's flowing in the wrong direction because you simply don't have enough real data, but you know the water level's flowing in another direction because, for instance, you know the shape of the plume. So, you know, yeah, I've seen cases where if you didn't add those data, you would interpret the water levels incorrectly and that
Thank
it
you.
Makes sense to add those data points to make an effective water level map.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Why don't we continue with the presentation?
Okay. I'm moving on to slide number 37. Now we're going to start talking about step 4, which is all about performing calculations. Calculations can range anywhere from doing a very simple calculator exercise that takes about 5 minutes to constructing and calibrating a groundwater flow model with particle tracking or transport modeling that might take weeks to months to create. So there's a wide range. And the complexity of the modeling that you will do will be somewhat dependent on how complicated your site is. We are certainly not suggesting that it's appropriate to do numerical modeling, something like ModFlow, at every site. We're going to talk about first some what I would call simple horizontal analyses that you can do very quickly. We're going to call one of them the estimated flow rate calculation and the other one a capture zone width calculation. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the more sophisticated numerical models in conjunction with particle tracking, for instance, that allow you to address more significant heterogeneities and complexities. So moving on to slide number 38. As I mentioned, there's two of these simple calculations we'll discuss. The first is called the estimated flow rate calculation. Here what we're doing is we're trying to estimate how much water is flowing through the contaminated part of the aquifer. If we know how much water is flowing through the contaminated part of the aquifer, we can then estimate how much water we have to pump to capture that water. The second, the capture zone width calculation, is kind of doing it in the other direction. In this case, we're saying we know how much water we're actually pumping. What we want to figure out is how wide a capture zone does that create. So those are the two types of calculations we're going to discuss next. Moving on to slide number 39. These are very simple analyses. Note the word simple on this slide. These are simple analyses, and they require simplifying assumptions to make them work. And they're based around the assumptions listed on this slide. A homogeneous, isotropic, confined aquifer of infinite extent that has one uniform aquifer thickness, fully penetrating extraction wells, a uniform regional hydraulic gradient in both direction and magnitude, steady state flow, meaning the flow system does not change over time. We have negligible vertical gradients. We have no net recharge, or the net recharge from precipitation, et cetera, is being accounted for in that background hydraulic gradient. And there's no other sources of water introduced to the aquifer from other locations. So in other words, we're not near a major river, so that when we pump, we're not capturing a lot of water from the river. Or when we pump, we're not capturing a lot of water from leakage from an underlying or overlying aquifer. Those are all assumptions that go into these simple calculations. And of course, you look at this and you go, well, my site doesn't meet all these restrictions. And, you know, very, very, very few sites in the real world meet all of these restrictions. That being said, this is a very easy calculation to make. And at many sites, even though you violate one or more of these limitations, it's still worthwhile to do the calculation. In fact, most pump tests that you analyze are subject to many of these same restrictions. So you make some of these assumptions, you calculate it, and then you decide afterwards how much reliance you want to put on this particular line of evidence based on how much you're deviating from the assumptions. To talk about the estimated flow rate calculation, I'm going to move on to slide number 40. And this slide first schematically illustrates what some of the parameters are using the pictures on the right. But first, let's look at the equation. Q, that's the extraction rate. That's what we're trying to calculate. And we can calculate that by taking the hydraulic conductivity, the saturated thickness of the aquifer, that's B, the plume width is W, I is the magnitude of the hydraulic gradient, so all those things multiplied together, times some factor, which by rule of thumb, we usually use a value of 1.5 to 2.0, and it is truly a fudge factor. I'll talk about it in more detail in a second. What we're doing here is calculating how much water is flowing through the plume. It says under the equation, must use consistent units, and that's very important. What it means is that you have to pick one unit for length and one unit for time. So if you have your hydraulic conductivity in centimeters per second and your plume width is in feet, that's bad. You need to do either everything in centimeters or everything in feet. That's what we mean by consistent units. The factor is to account for the fact that when you're calculating how much water is flowing through the plume, in all likelihood, when you pump from an extraction well or a series of extraction wells, you're going to get some other sources of water other than the water that's in the plume. You might have some surface water nearby. You might have some leakage from above and below. Our method assumes that we don't, but then we build in this factor to account for the fact that we probably do have some water coming from outside of the contaminated plume. And that's why we have this factor. There's no scientific basis for assigning it. It's just, as I mentioned, a rule of thumb that people tend to use a value of 1.5 or 2.0 to account for that. If we move on to slide number 41, this provides an example calculation just with some numbers. Here we have a value for hydraulic conductivity, for aquifer thickness, for plume width, and for hydraulic gradient. We multiply all those together using the equation. You'll notice here that at the end, we multiply it all together, and then we have some factors in there to convert cubic feet per minute into gallons per minute so that at the end of the day, we have our result in gallons per minute. And then what we do is we say at the end, okay, if we just did the calculation straight out with no factor, we would get 15 gallons per minute. If we assume the factor is 1.5, then we get 22.5 gallons a minute we would have to pump. And if the factor was 2.0, we'd have to pump 30 gallons per minute. And the way someone might use this calculation is say, okay, we probably need to pump somewhere between 15 and 30 gallons per minute. Now, that range might be greater if there's more uncertainty in the parameter values. You may not know the hydraulic conductivity is 28 feet. Per day, it might be, well, we think it's between 20 and 40 feet per day, and then you might calculate a range of values. But that's the way you use this. So just using this example, if you think that based on this calculation, you should be pumping somewhere between 15 and 30 gallons per minute, and your actual system pumps 35 gallons a minute, you feel pretty good. But if it pumps only 5 gallons per minute, you don't feel very good. And that's the kind of way you use this line of evidence. Moving on to slide number 42. This illustrates how we do the capture zone width calculation. This is an analytical solution. There's a lot of equations listed on this slide. The top line lists two forms of a very difficult equation that draws the capture zone curve in terms of the x-coordinate and the y-coordinate. And it's complicated. If you look, for instance, at the right-hand side, y equals a bunch of stuff, you'll notice that y is also appears on the right-hand side of the equation. That's what makes it a very difficult equation. We simplify this equation by using the equations on the second line, which we are able to calculate certain easy points. X sub 0 is the distance in the direction of groundwater flow down gradient of the extraction well where the capture zone ends. It's called the stagnation point. X sub 0 can be calculated as the pumping rate divided by 2 times pi times the transmissivity times the gradient. And it's negative because it's in the negative x direction. So we can very easily, if we know the pumping rate and we can estimate the transmissivity and the hydraulic gradient in the background, we can very quickly estimate how far it is to that stagnation point. Similarly, we can calculate y max and y well. Y max is the distance from the x-axis to the edge of the capture zone, far up gradient of the pumping well, and y well is that same distance in the vicinity of the pumping well. And you can see that it's a plus or a minus because you can go in the positive direction in y, and you can go in the negative direction in y. And this is a very simple calculation for getting, once you can calculate those 5 points, basically, x sub 0 plus and minus y well plus and minus y max, you can very quickly sketch in the outline of a capture zone and get a feel for the capture zone width. If we move on to the next slide, slide number 43, this just gives, again, a very simple example using some numbers where we have values for the pumping rate. Notice in this case, the pumping rate is in gallons per minute, and the hydraulic conductivity is in feet per day. Those are not consistent units. So when we illustrate the calculation below, the first thing we have to do is convert our pumping rate from gallons per minute into cubic feet per day so that we can then have consistent units for the rest of the calculation. And what you'll see here is using these simple parameters, we calculate the stagnation distance is 225 feet, the Y-max is 706 feet, and the Y-well is 353 feet. Now, one of the important things to look at, if you were to go back and look at slide number 42, is you'll notice that there's only one pumping well. This very simple method generally is applied for one pumping well. Now, most sites have more than one pumping well. So what do? Well, there's several things you can try to do. What's generally done is you collapse all of the pumping. Let's say you have 6 pumping wells. You collapse it all into one representative location. You pick a location that's kind of in the middle, that's representative of the center of massive pumping. You put all the pumping together at that one location and calculate the entire width of capture. Some people try to calculate an individual capture zone at each individual extraction well. That is generally not recommended if those wells are close by because they do interfere with each other. And doing it in that manner, it just generally is not accurate. It is accurate that when you put them all together at one representative location, the result will generally give you the approximate resulting width of the whole pumping system. But by doing them individually and you're not accounting for the interference between them, it's generally not the right thing to do. And if those kinds of details are important to you, this simple method will not work, and you'll have to go to something more like a numerical model or an analytic element model or something like that. I'm now going to move on to slide number 44. This just summarizes some of these simple calculations. They're easy to apply. They force a basic review of the conceptual model. That's why we think you should always do them. Even if your site does not meet those assumptions, just do the calculation. It'll force you to think about what's the hydraulic conductivity and what's the saturated thickness and do I know what the gradient is and et cetera, et cetera. So it's worth doing. If you look at the equations closely, you'll clearly see some important relationships. The capture zone width will decrease if your hydraulic conductivity increases. The capture zone width will decrease if your hydraulic gradient is higher. And your hydraulic your capture zone width will decrease if you have a higher aquifer thickness. So those relationships come right out of those equations, and it's important to understand those. Again, the assumptions are almost always violated, but you should still use these as scoping calculations. Also note, we call these simple horizontal analyses. These don't in any way address whether there's flow of water up or down to an adjacent aquifer or whether the contaminant might be diving or anything like that. It's purely a horizontal analysis. If the vertical analysis is really important in your case, then you probably need to go to more of a numerical model that allows you to assess the full three-dimensionality. Now, moving on to slide number 45, this now takes the calculations to the next level, which would be more like groundwater flow model with particle tracking. These are very easy to apply in three dimensions. They can be used, therefore, to evaluate both horizontal and vertical aspects of capture. The second bullet indicates an important point. It's very easy to be misled by pictures. One of the nice things about particle tracking is you can make really cool pictures, but if you are reviewing a report that's been done by someone who's done a model and you don't have a real good background in modeling, you probably want to seek out the assistance of a coworker or a support personnel, a contractor, whatever is available to you, to make sure that that modeling effort is reviewed by somebody who knows a little something about modeling. You know, it's easy to be misled by pictures. Just because somebody put it on a picture doesn't mean it's right. The third bullet talks about the difference between precision and accuracy. Numerical models are very precise. They calculate the water level to 5 or 6 decimal places. That doesn't mean they're correct. A lot of people use the word garbage in, garbage out. They kind of disparage numerical modeling by saying, well, there's so much uncertainty in all the parameters and the boundary conditions that, you know, it's just, you know, we don't trust the output of the model. And I think that disparagement of models is a little over the top. I think that what you really want to see is a numerical model that's been calibrated and then that's been what we call verified or validated. And what we mean by that, when you're calibrating the model, you're basically demonstrating that the model reasonably simulates observed conditions. Usually the primary calibration target is water levels. You're trying to prove that the simulated water levels match the observed water levels. And ideally, you'd want to do that for multiple stressed conditions, a pre-pumping condition perhaps, but more importantly, conditions with 3 pumping wells, and then maybe another condition with 5 pumping wells, or something like that, so that you really get a good feel that the model is somewhat robust. Now, to verify that the model is a decent predictor, what is generally recommended is that you try to demonstrate that the model can predict something accurately. And when we're talking about capture zones, one of the things that a model can predict is drawdown responses to pumping. One of the nice things about a pump and treat system is that you have an instant pump test waiting to happen. You've already got wells, you've already got pumps, you've already got a treatment system. So you can try all kinds of different pumping configurations and measure observed drawdowns due to pumping in the field. You can then try to simulate those with your groundwater model. And to the extent you prove that your model reasonably simulates those observations, you are verifying that your model can predict one of the critical aspects of capture zone analysis, which is the drawdown due to pumping. Because as we discussed earlier, truly what a capture zone is the superposition of a regional hydraulic gradient and drawdown due to capture. So if you can prove that your model adequately simulates a regional gradient, and then you can also prove that your model reasonably predicts drawdown due to pumping, then you go a long way towards demonstrating confidence in the predictions of your model. And here the schematic on the right is just showing the kind of pictures you can make from particle tracking. Here we're showing a bunch of particles being released. Every point that's highlighted represents a particle that was released in this aquifer that was ultimately captured by one of the 3 pumping wells. They're each colored differently to show the capture zone of each well. Again, it's just a great way to illustrate a capture zone. Moving on to slide number 46, this slide illustrates what one of the pitfalls would be when I talk about how you can be misled by a picture. Here what we have is the picture on the left is the same picture we were just looking at, and that represents capture in the shallow portion of the aquifer. And the picture on the right represents capture in the deeper portion of the aquifer. In this particular case, we have partially penetrating wells. These three extraction wells are partially penetrating wells. Now, if I gave you a modeling report and it only showed the picture on the left and I said, here's the capture zone of these three pumping wells, you go, oh, that's pretty good relative to the plume boundary. But if I showed you both pictures and said, okay, the capture zone looks pretty good in the shallow part of the aquifer, but as we move deeper, the capture zone kind of loses its oomph, and we're only capturing a much smaller part of the aquifer because the wells are just partially penetrating wells, that gives you a totally different conclusion. And again, that's why it's important to have somebody who, you know, it has some understanding of groundwater flow modeling to help you evaluate that if you don't have that experience yourself. Moving on to slide number 47, we'll now go to step 5, which is concentration trends. We define, for the purpose of evaluating concentration trends for capture zone evaluation, two types of wells: sentinel wells and down gradient performance monitoring wells. A sentinel well is down gradient of your target capture zone and it's clean, and we want it to stay clean. A down gradient performance monitoring well is down gradient of your target capture zone and it's dirty. And if capture is successful, we expect it will clean up over time. Let's move on to slide number 48. This is a schematic used to illustrate why both sentinel wells and down gradient performance monitoring wells are all located down gradient of your target capture zone. The reason is illustrated on this slide. Here we have a plume where the most contaminated portion of the plume is the sort of olive green, where it says plume with continuous source. And we have a pumping well in red, and we have a monitoring well that is located inside the capture zone. That's the black circle. Now, when we start pumping this extraction well, because this monitor well is inside the capture zone, we don't really know what's going to happen to the concentrations. The concentrations might go up, they might go down, or they might stay relatively consistent. That's because we have a continuing source of contamination. And it might be that when we start pumping, we might actually draw more contaminated water into that well. So we really just don't know what's going to happen, and that's what makes it really not usable for evaluating capture. We illustrate this again if we look at slide number 49. So moving on to that slide. Here we have our plume again, and we have our target capture zone, and we show three monitoring wells down gradient of an extraction well. Well MW1 is inside the capture zone. It's very difficult to use that as a remediation target. Well 2 is what we call a down gradient performance monitoring well, and it is, you know, currently impacted. We expect if capture is sufficient that it will become less impacted over time. Well 3 is a sentinel well. It's currently clean. Ideally, we would like that well to stay clean over time if capture is sufficient. You know, it's possible it might become mildly impacted if you look at this case based on the toe of the plume migrating, but ideally we'd like that well to stay clean over time. If we look at the next slide, which is well number 50, this might be an idealized version of the concentration histories you might see. At MW1, which is inside the capture zone, it might go down, it might go up. In this case, we're showing a slight decline, but it might stay well above cleanup levels, which are illustrated by the horizontal red line. And the reason for that is because of the continuing source of contamination and flow paths that continue to flow through this monitor well on the way to the extraction well. At the downgrade in performance monitoring well, we do expect that it will clean up over time. And at the sentinel well, we hope that it will stay clean over time, as illustrated here. Now, a few things to note about concentration trends. Number one is there's a bit of a catch-22. What we're saying is we're trying to interpret the capture zone. We don't know what the capture zone is. Yet, somehow, for these wells, we need to know whether they're inside or outside of the capture zone to know whether they're properly located or not. So that is a difficult catch-22. And the way you start to get around that is by combining other lines of evidence. For instance, calculate the distance to the stagnation point using those simple analytical type of calculations we were talking about before. Or perhaps you have a numerical model and you estimate how far it is to the down gradient edge of the capture zone using a numerical model. Then you make some determination of whether your monitor wells are likely inside or outside of the capture zone. That's how you start using multiple lines of evidence. Another thing to notice on this particular plot on slide number 50 is that the axis, the x-axis, is in years. generally, we're only collecting water quality data annually, semi-annually. We don't collect very much of it, and it takes a long time to establish trends. Plus, groundwater moves relatively slowly, and plumes concentrations change slowly over time. So this particular line of evidence has a lot of ambiguity, and it may take a long time to be able to interpret it, and water quality monitoring is a good bit more expensive than water level monitoring. So if we move on to slide number 51, this just summarizes some of what we're talking about for concentration data. The wells must be located properly. There's a problem if they're located inside the capture zone. Even when these wells are located properly, it might take a long time to use this line of evidence to indicate successful capture. If we move on to slide number 52, this is an important statement at the top of slide number 52. Although these issues complicate this line of evidence, there are complications. The concentration trend data, the water quality data over time, may ultimately provide your most solid and compelling line of evidence that successful capture is achieved, or the corollary that, capture is failing. For instance, I could have a water level map that shows I have successful capture. I could have a numerical model that says I have capture. But if I have wells down gradient of my system that were clean and are now becoming dirty, well, that's pretty compelling evidence that I maybe have a problem. Similarly, I may have some ambiguity in my water level maps, or I may have some uncertainty in my numerical modeling, but if I have wells that were dirty and that I expect to clean up over time, and they do clean up over time, that is very compelling evidence that I'm achieving an adequate degree of capture. Therefore, what's recommended is that you use a combination of both hydraulic monitoring and chemical monitoring. The hydraulic data allows for rapid assessment of the system performance, but this chemical data does allow for long-term assessment based on field-collected data, and it's very compelling. So now we'll quickly go through step number 6, moving on to slide number 53. This is where we take the first two steps, which were the preliminary steps of setting up our target capture zone and the like, you know, looking at our site conceptual model and our remedy objectives. We've now done steps 3, 4, and 5, where we're trying to figure out how large our extent of capture is. And then on step 6, we're pulling it all together. We're comparing our interpreted and our target capture zone to determine whether we're successful or not, and we're doing that three-dimensionally. We're assessing uncertainties. Again, we're not asking, are there uncertainties? We're saying, are there uncertainties that are calling into question our overall conclusion? We try to avoid that by using multiple lines of evidence. The more lines of evidence we have, the less any one type of uncertainty comes into play. We assess the need to fill such uncertainties if they are significantly, or if they are potentially impacting our conclusions. We might need to add some monitor wells or piezometers. We might need to verify the predictions of our groundwater model, etc. And then at the end, we determine whether there's a cause to increase or decrease our pumping rates, whether there's cause to add extraction wells, perhaps decrease the number of extraction wells, et cetera. Moving on to slide number 54, we've mentioned several times during this presentation this concept of converging lines of evidence. In many cases, this interpretation of capture is ambiguous. As I mentioned before, the best approach is to have multiple lines of evidence that each support the same conclusion. Every time you add more lines of evidence, you add confidence in your conclusion. If your only line of evidence in your capture zone evaluation is, I did one of these simple horizontal capture zone calculations, and I estimate there's 50 gallons per minute flowing through the plume, and I'm pumping 50, well, that's one line of evidence, but that's not nearly as compelling as saying, I did this calculation, and it looks okay, but I also have a water level map, and it seems to indicate capture, and I've got some key water level pairs that are showing an inward gradient where I expect it to be inward, and I've got a numerical model, and it, you know, I've calibrated it, and I've, you know, it's also showing it, and, you know, every time you add these lines of evidence, it just makes it that much more convincing. I also mentioned earlier that you can increase your confidence in any line of evidence by pumping more, and that's generally a good thing, except that it might add significant cost. It's a site-specific factor, depends on the type of treatment and the type of pumping cost you have. It may not be feasible because of restrictions in your piping or your treatment plant process, And pumping more water just may cause other problems, such as dewatering nearby well screens or dewatering a wetland. So all those factors need to be considered. Moving on to slide number 55, this simply provides an example of a structure for presenting a capture zone evaluation using this kind of systematic approach. Here it's just being shown as a table where you talk about your water levels, you talk about your calculations, you talk about your concentration trends. Each one you reach a conclusion as to what that line of evidence shows. You might add some comments that indicate how much uncertainty you have or any key data gaps or any other observations you have about that particular line of evidence. And then at the end, you give an overall conclusion about whether or not capture is successful, whether there's any key uncertainties that are calling into question your conclusions, and whatever recommendations you might have for increasing or decreasing the pumping rates, et cetera. Now, for many sites, this may not be a table. A table might be overly simplistic, or it might be a multi-page table. It might be multiple chapters within a report or multiple sections within a chapter of a report. This is just indicating that you might have a structure of a capture zone presentation, as opposed to simply reading, say, a line in a report that says, we have done a capture zone evaluation and capture appears to be sufficient. If you read something like that and that's the extent of it, that's not a particularly rigorous capture zone evaluation. You really want to look at this sort of approach where you're looking at the different lines of evidence and then reaching conclusions based on those lines of evidence. We're almost done. Just a couple more slides. Slide number 56. Here we're going to look at, very quickly, we're not going to go through all the detail on these slides, but this is just an example of the way you might present a capture zone evaluation and identify some red flags. Here, step number one, plume delineation. The last plume delineation was 5 years ago. That's a problem. If your last water quality data is 5 years ago, you don't really know whether your plume is delineated or not, and that's a red flag. It's unclear if the remedy objective is cleanup or containment. You know, that's a red flag if you don't have a real prioritization of how does the goal of hydraulic containment fit into your remedy, and are you trying to hydraulically contain the whole plume or just a part of the plume? Here's step number two, target capture zone. It's not clearly defined. It's not, for instance, put on site figures. When you make a water level map, there's no indication of what the target capture zone is. Those are red flags. Water level maps. The water levels indicate a large capture zone. However, water levels are used at the extraction wells with no correction for well inefficiencies or well losses, and there's no piezometers anywhere near the extraction wells. That is an immediate red flag. Let's move on to slide number 57. One of these simple horizontal capture zone analyses is performed. We estimate the amount of flow through the plume is 50 to 100 gallons per minute, but we're only pumping 40 gallons per minute. That's a red flag. In this particular case, there's no groundwater model to use as another line of evidence. The concentration trends are inconclusive. Again, there's so many red flags in this analysis, you really don't even know where to start. When you get to step six, you would just quickly have to say, there's problems here, we don't have a target capture zone, we don't really know what our remedy objective is, we have issues with our water level maps, there's just a lot of red flags that we need to go back and sort some of that out. But now just a couple of summary slides and we can take some final questions. Some key concepts that we've touched upon in this presentation, these suggested six steps provide a systematic approach. You can use them as a somewhat general checklist when you're doing a capture zone evaluation or when you're reviewing a capture zone evaluation. It's important to know what the remedy goal is with respect to hydraulic capture, whether you're trying to capture just part of the plume or whether you're trying to hydraulically capture the entire plume. And coming right out of that, it's important to have a target capture zone that's clearly defined, that's understood by stakeholders, that's consistent with the remedy objectives, and recognize if it's based on concentration contours, it might grow or shrink over time. This concept of converging lines of evidence is important. And you want to rely to the extent possible on field collected data. Models are great. Models provide nice pictures. Models are very powerful for looking at three dimensions. But even your models, You want to calibrate and verify those predictions to the extent possible based on field-collected data. And you want to use those other lines of evidence like water level maps and water quality trends that are based on real field-collected data as much as possible. And moving on to slide number 59, the need for additional field data should be routinely evaluated to address any key data gaps. And then finally, what's the appropriate frequency for this? How often do I have to do a capture zone evaluation? It's very hard to make a universal rule that says everybody should do it twice a year. That's not really appropriate. It's site-specific. But some of the factors that you need to consider are, for instance, where are my receptors and how fast is my groundwater flow? For instance, if I've got a site with relatively low contamination, my closest receptor is 2 miles away, and my groundwater flow is 100 feet per year, I probably don't need to do monthly capture zone evaluations because the receptors are far away and the groundwater flows slowly. However, if I have a high degree of contamination and I have receptors that are 1,000 feet away and my groundwater flows 300 feet per year or 500 feet per year, well, then the frequency of capture zone evaluation might need to be a lot more frequent. Similarly, you need to consider the transientness of the system. Again, if you have a high tide and low tide condition, you might need to present a capture zone evaluation for both conditions. Doesn't mean you have to do two capture zone evaluations every day. It means you have to account for the fact that you have a high tide and a low tide and evaluate those end member conditions that applies each day. Similarly, if you have a wet season and a dry season, or a pumping season and a non-pumping season, you might need to do capture zone evaluations for each of those seasons. Certainly, multiple capture zone evaluations throughout the first year of system operation is appropriate. One or more evaluations per year is appropriate at many sites. There are some sites where perhaps less frequent is acceptable, but at most sites, you know, at least once per year is generally a good rule. At some sites, it might need to be more frequent than that for the reasons I stated. And finally, slide number 60. Many aspects of capture zone evaluation require hydrogeologic expertise. Not everybody who is in the role of reviewing one of these is a hydrogeologist or, say, is an expert in groundwater modeling or contouring, for instance. So seek out support personnel when you don't have the experience yourself to help you along. Recognize that the simple calculations in and of themselves are usually not sufficient, that you generally need to have more lines of evidence than just one of those simple back-of-the-envelope calculations, and scrutinize the interpretation of each line of evidence, such as if you have a water level map, but you have it's based on water levels at the extraction wells, well, that de-emphasizes that line of evidence as valid. You then want to either address that line of evidence better, or you want to rely on other lines of evidence with more weight. And with that, we will take some final questions.
Thanks, Rob. I'm going to read one off of the online questions. The first question concerns dense non-aqueous phase liquids that exhibit a specific gravity greater than 1. Is it reasonable to assume that the dissolved phase concentrations would be found in higher concentration at the bottom of the aquifer down gradient of the source DNAPL? And is that also a reasonable assumption if you do no longer have a source?
Wow, that's a lot of stuff about DNAPL. That's not necessarily a capture zone question, but I'll take a crack. If you have a dissolved phase concentration resulting from a DNAPL, it says, is it reasonable to assume that you would have higher concentrations at the bottom of the aquifer? And that's not necessarily the case, because just because you have a DNAPL doesn't mean you have a pool of DNAPL at the bottom of an aquifer. The pool of DNAPL or the residual DNAPL could be caught up in the unsaturated zone, such that your dissolved plume still has the highest concentrations near the top of the aquifer. You may have a case where you have DNAPL in the unsaturated zone, and periodically the water table rises and falls, such that it's being introduced at the top of the aquifer in a dissolved phase. So just because you have a DNAPL beneath the ground in some form doesn't mean that your dissolved concentrations are going to be higher at the bottom. Now, if in fact the pool of DNAPL is sitting at the bottom of the aquifer, sitting on top of some clay, then it might be, in that particular case, reasonable to expect to find the higher concentrations at the bottom. So that's what I would answer that particular part of it. Trying to remember, was there more to that question, Linda?
No, I think that it had to do with concentrations in the lower part of the aquifer. So why don't we go on? We'll have one more question online, and then we'll go to the phone. Do you have experience with useful models for estimating capture zones that also incorporate LNAPA recovery estimations and capture zones? For instance, if you quantified transmissivity of both LNAPA and groundwater within a given affected water-bearing zone, can I incorporate that information into a capture model?
I personally do not have experience with that. I do know that there was a guidance document published by EPA several years back. I don't have the title off the top of my head, but it had to do with LNAPA recovery. I suspect if you just did a Google search on, you know, EPA guidance LNAPA recovery, you'd probably find that document. And I suspect that type of issue is discussed well in that particular document. But I don't have that experience myself, and I don't know which models I'd refer the questioner to.
Still related to LNAPA, so I think you've already answered it. Okay, let's go to the phones. Remember to hit #6 to unmute your phone. Do we have a question on the phone line?
Yes. Well, this is Roland Clark with the Postal Service. On the capture zone calculations, if you don't know, well, you know that one well is not going to be enough to capture your plume. Could you just do a calculation for one well and then just do some overlapping of those to calculate the total number of wells?
Yeah, exactly right. What you can do is, so for instance, the capture zone width calculation, you take your hydraulic conductivity, your saturated thickness, your hydraulic gradient, et cetera, and you calculate, you know, in that factor. Let's say I think the factor is 1.5. You make that, you know, it's a fudge factor, and you say, I think I need 200 gallons per minute to capture this plume. That doesn't mean you have to have one well pumping 200 gallons per minute. You could put, you know, five wells in, each pumping 40 gallons per minute, spread them out along a line or in some pattern near the down gradient edge of the plume or perhaps right up the axis of the plume. The concept is that you're calculating with that calculation about how much water you have to pump in total to remove that much water. And you can spread that out amongst a number of wells as long as the wells aren't so far apart that they really are capturing completely independent areas of the plume.
Well, if you have an idea of what how much an aquifer can give up per well, and you have a pretty broad plume, I mean, wouldn't you do it the other way? You would do your capture zone width calculation using the flow rate that you have and then overlap those somehow?
Yeah, you could do it either way. It's just, again, my here's the problem. If you do the capture zone width calculation for the individual wells, it doesn't account for the interference between them. So, again, what I would do in that case is you say, okay, I know a pumping well can, you can get about 50 gallons per minute for each well, for instance. You do the capture zone width calculation to say, okay, if I pump 250 gallons per minute, is my capture zone width going to be sufficient? And you put that at one representative well, and you say, okay, looks good. Now you say, but I know I only get 50 gallons per minute per well. So at that, then what you do is you say, so I'm going to need five wells because I can only pump 50 gallons per minute per well. That's the way I would do it. You wouldn't do five individual capture zone width calculations because of the interference. If you need that level of detail, you go to a numerical model because that more or an analytic element model, which is just another kind of modeling, because those more directly account for the interference between the wells.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we had another question on the phone.
Yeah, that's my call phone was H2. I just want to confirm something in your 4A calculation for the width and the pumping rate. Now, the horizontal direction, you're just looking at the width that you want your actual capture zone. But in the vertical direction, your saturated thickness needs to be the full saturated thickness of the aquifer, not just your vertical capture zone. Is that right?
That's right. That's a good question. It's what it really is. The B in that is the thickness of aquifer that you believe your well is going to be capturing from. So let's say you have a very, very, very thick aquifer. Let's say your aquifer is 2,000 feet thick and your well penetrates 100 feet into the aquifer. Well, I wouldn't necessarily use 100 feet for that thickness because I don't think my 100-foot partially penetrating well is capturing the whole 2,000 feet of the aquifer. I wouldn't use 2,000 feet because I don't... Well, I wouldn't use 2,000 feet. I wouldn't use 100 feet because I do believe it's probably capturing from some depth greater than the screen interval of the well. So you would have to somehow decide what you think the width being captured is. But that's the width you'd want to use for that calculation is what you think is ultimately going to be the thickness that's being captured. Is that what you're trying to get at?
Yeah, and short of going to a numeric model, is there any way to estimate what that... I mean, obviously, you've got to know your vertical anisotropy. But is that the best way to do it? I mean, how would you estimate what that thickness would be?
It's very difficult to do. There might be an analytic solution out there, but for me personally, I would just make a very simple numerical model very quickly. You know, it wouldn't have to be a site-specific model. It could just be a generic, simple model, but then you could play around with the anisotropy and see how much it varies based on that parameter and then take your best shot or use your best range. That's the way I would do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I'd make a very simple model. Using the example I was just giving, let's say I have a 2,000-foot aquifer. I might divide that into, make a very simple generic model, divide it into, say, 20 model layers, each of which is 100 feet thick. I have my 100-foot well in layer one, and then I play around with my vertical anisotropy and see how deep my capture zone goes. Or I might have to make it 200-foot thick layers or something, but see for different layers of anisotropy or levels of anisotropy, how deep does my capture zone extend? And then, but once you're there, now you've already got a numerical model, so you might already be past making those simple calculations.
Right, and so as a practical matter, if you've got partially penetrating wells and fairly thick aquifers, you're probably going to have to go to a numerical model to really understand it.
Correct. Yeah, I guess that's where I was getting to with my comment was if you have to make the numerical model just to get at the issue of the anisotropy, now you've already got the numerical model, so you're pretty well there already. Thanks for that question, though. It's a very good question.
Okay, we can take one more from the phone. Okay, well, we have several questions online. The next is from Bill Locke with Integral Consulting in Colorado. Do you have any general guidance to offer regarding optimizing capture zones and pumping rates for plumes in near-shore environments, near rivers, bays, or estuaries that act as constant head boundaries?
Well, several things you have to consider in those situations. Number one is, if they truly are constant head boundaries, then what you have to be concerned with is when you put your pumping wells, if your pumping wells are very close to the constant head boundary, then it's going to impact the capture zone width, because some of the water, instead of coming from the plume, is going to be coming from that boundary. That calls into question the use of those simple calculations. Remember, we're assuming in those calculations that water is not coming from other boundaries, or just some small amount of water that we're attributing that factor to. But as you put your pumping wells very close to such boundaries, you know, you can really impact, your capture zone width will become reduced because you're capturing a bunch of the water from the boundary itself. Now, another thing to consider is whether or not those are really constant head boundaries. Again, a lot of times in those environments, you're dealing with tidal fluctuations. That can add a huge degree of complexity because your boundary head might be higher and lower, and there might be times during the day when flow is inward from the boundary to the aquifer and other times when the flow is outward. And to do that, there's implications in several ways. Firstly, for a numerical model, that's something which can be modeled, but it requires a lot of sophistication. For measuring water levels, you might have tidal impacts where you need to account for the tidal impacts, and it's beyond the scope of this to get into that. You can certainly read papers on that, but there's several ways to do that. You either time your water levels so that you're in the same part of the tidal cycle, or you calculate, you collect your water levels, and then you calculate a corrected water level based on a time lag and a magnitude lag. So those are all some of the factors that you have to consider. It makes it a lot more complicated.
Okay. Our next question is from Jim Banantine with Arcadis in Wisconsin. Can you please review the concept of water level pairs and their interpretation?
Well, the concept of water level pairs is you just, rather than having a lot of wells where you're making a map, say a water level map, you're just looking at specific pairs of locations that are relatively close together. So again, let me give the easiest example for me to comprehend is near a river. Is water flowing from the aquifer to the river or from the river to the aquifer? Because let's say our remediation goal is to prevent contaminants from continuing to discharge to the river. Well, one type of way you could do that is say, well, my remedial goal is to reverse the gradient, so I'm now bringing water from the river to the aquifer. That might be a little extreme, but let's just use it as an example for here. So I want to know if water is going from the aquifer to the river or the river to the aquifer. So I put a stage measurement device in the river, so I always know the stage, and I put a water level measurement point in the aquifer adjacent to the river, and I look at the two water levels, and they're a pair. If the stage of the river is higher than the water level in the aquifer, then flow is from the river into the aquifer. But if the water level is higher in the aquifer than the stage of the river, then water flow is from the aquifer into the river. And that's a way you would use pairs to evaluate whether you have flow in one direction or flow in another direction.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Another question from Nam Bach with GSHI in Texas. Can you tell me a little more about particle tracking? Where do you use this particle tracking method and what for?
Particle tracking is simply an add-on to a numerical flow model. So once you make a numerical flow model, such as with a code like ModFlow, which is a very commonly used code, ModFlow predicts groundwater levels. Well, the next question you generally want to ask is, okay, based on those groundwater levels, what's the size of my capture zone? And the way you can determine that is by using this add-on to the groundwater flow model called particle tracking. And there's a lot, I can't teach all the ways to evaluate capture zones with particle tracking here, but the simplest way is you just draw a line of particles up gradient of your pumping wells and track those particles flow forward, and that's what the particle tracking code will do. It'll say, for a particle that starts here, it'll move to this location, this location, this location, this location, and ultimately it'll go to this well. Or another particle will say it'll go to this location, this location, this location, this location, and ultimately flow past the well. And you can make pictures of those particle tracks. And therefore, you can use the particle tracking to illustrate which particles end up at the well and which particles do not end up at the well. So that's just my simple explanation of what particle tracking is and how you use it. To go much more beyond that would require more of a modeling discussion, which I don't think we have time for.
Okay, at this point, it's 4 o'clock. I'm going to ask Rob, can you stay on and answer some more questions?
Absolutely.
Okay. If you do need to sign off, I encourage you to fill out the feedback form. You'll see a link on the last slide of the presentation, and there also you will see a link to the page that has all of the document links. And so that we do hope that you have enjoyed the seminar, but we'll keep going and answer these additional questions. I'll go to the phone line again. Are there any other questions on the phone? Okay, well, our next question is...
Linda, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure, Kathy.
There are two of the questions that have been posted regard the X and Y coordinates on the equation on page 42. Can we jump to those to make sure they're answered because they're duplicative questions?
Sure. Rob, do you see the questions
sure.
on figure 42? How do you determine the X coordinate for the Y max?
And Kathy, did you want to take a crack at them or do you want me to do it?
No, I was just pointing it out. That's all. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just trying to suck you in there.
I know. Nice try.
Okay, on figure 42, how do you determine the x-coordinate for y-max? And the other one is, can you explain the x and y-coordinates in the first equation on page 42? Okay, so I'm going to go to slide 42. What I would say is that first equation on the top is, I wouldn't worry about that equation. I would just use the equations on the second line. What the equation on the top line is doing is, if you look at the schematic on slide 42, the capture zone is a line. For every X on this figure, is it's indicated. It's in the positive X direction, to the right. And Y is, the positive Y direction is upward. In this particular case, groundwater flow is from right to left across the screen. That's the arrow on the top of the figure with the eye above it, and the eye represents the hydraulic gradient. What the equation is saying, the top equation, which is a very difficult equation, is saying, is that if I know the value of x, there is a way to calculate the value of y at every point where there's a value of x. It's just, it's not easy to do it because the equation's so complicated. So it could be done. It can be done. You can program a scheme. You need a numerical scheme to calculate it, but you can calculate it if you really wanted to. What I was trying to say when I went through this slide is you generally don't want to do that because it's complicated. Instead, all you want to calculate is x sub 0, y max, and y well. And in the case of y max and y well, there's a positive y max and a negative y max. So if we looked at that, if everybody who is interested is looking at that figure, x sub 0, firstly, is the distance to the stagnation point. It's a negative value because it's in the negative x direction. The positive x direction is going to the right. The stagnation point is down gradient of the pumping well. It's going to the left, and that's why it's a negative value. For y well and for y max, they are measured, they're the distance from the x-axis. So if you look at y max, it's the capture zone width far up gradient of the pumping well, the distance from the x-axis. So there's a positive y max for the top half of the capture zone, and there's a negative y max for the bottom half. So the actual width of the capture zone is those two half thicknesses added together. So the real width of the capture zone is 2 times y max. Kathy, do you think that answered the question?
I think so.
So you don't determine the x-coordinate for y-max. Getting to the one where the question was, how do you determine the x-coordinate for y-max? You don't determine the x-coordinate. Y-max is simply the curve becomes asymptotic. At some point, that value doesn't change as x increases. So you're just calculating what y-max is at some distance far up gradient. And at y well, it's, you're calculating it at the location where the pumping well is, and you just sort of sketch it in, and it's close enough. That's the way you use that. If you think something needs to be added, Kathy, feel free.
No, I think you just did by that last part. I think, unless the person's still on the phone and they want to speak up.
Yeah, those two questions were online, so they can't. Talking to the computer, unfortunately. Okay, so moving along, we have 3 more questions online, so let's see if we can get through them. The next question is from Brad Casera with Tetra Tech in Montana again. He says, building on my previous question related to concentration distribution, should we be basing our SEM with respect to vertical distribution on vertically separated water quality samples? For instance, PDB set at multiple elevations within a single well.
Yes. Well, here's my short answer to a complicated question, which is, if you suspect that your dissolved concentrations are vertically distributed unevenly, meaning, for instance, you might have higher concentrations near the bottom of the aquifer, as we were talking about before, or you might have higher concentrations near the top of the aquifer, as we were talking about before, if you suspect that's the case, and you suspect that's important in the way you're going to manage your system, then absolutely you need to do some depth discrete sampling, whether that be using PDBs at multiple elevations, whether that be putting in clusters of wells. You know, there's many ways to look at, maybe with a MIPS probe. There's all kinds of ways you can evaluate that, but if that's important to delineate your dissolved concentrations vertically because you think there's differences, then you need to do that. Now, the other side of the coin is you might have a site that has a let's say a 50-foot aquifer, and below that aquifer you have a very tight clay, and you have an aquifer below that, and it's clean, and you have lots of samples from that deeper aquifer, and they're all clean, and you don't think it's going to get dirty for whatever reason. Maybe you have an upward gradient even from that deeper aquifer to your upper aquifer. So now you're focusing in on your upper aquifer, and I forget if I said, let's assume that's 50 feet thick. Now, it may be that there is a higher concentrations at the bottom than at the top, or it may be that there's higher concentrations at the top than at the bottom. But it may also be the fact that for the purposes of your remediation system that you really don't care about that. That what you really care about is horizontally containing that entire 50-foot aquifer. And if that's the case, then no, you don't really need to know that. You're just going to proceed with your evaluation based on your remediation goal, which is to contain the entire thickness of that aquifer. So if that's your remediation goal, it really doesn't matter whether it's 100 at the top and 1,000 at the bottom, or 1,000 at the top and 100 at the bottom. Your goal is to contain the whole aquifer. You treat it as one aquifer, and you move forward doing your water levels, and you move forward doing your capture zone width calculations and all that, treating it as one aquifer. Kathy, do you have anything to add to that, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I would just caution if there's semi-confining units or confining units between the different zones, you don't want to treat it as one full aquifer. I just want to clarify that, right?
Absolutely.
And you wouldn't want to have an open well across different zones of different contaminant levels, because most likely they have different heads, and you could cause cross-contamination within the borehole or within the well screen.
Right, but based on the question that was asked earlier, I was assuming that what they're referring to is you have sort of like an aquifer that might have some DNAPL in either the top or the bottom, so you might have a difference in contaminant distribution. And my point is, if it's one aquifer, one 50-foot aquifer that is relatively homogeneous, you may not care whether it's contaminated more at the top or the bottom. Or you may.
Right. It all goes back to what are you trying to do at your particular site, and what's your site conceptual model.
Right, and what are your remediation goals, and what's the goals of your pumetry system for hydraulic capture?
Right.
Is it to capture the whole plume or the most contaminated part of the plume? So all those things have to be factored in before you answer that question.
Right.
Okay. I think that addresses the next part of that question, which is online, which is, this is important. I want to know about the dissolved concentration and the distribution with respect to the vertical for developing a site conceptual model for vertical capture. I think that's just getting at exactly what Kathy and I were just talking about, which is, if that is important because you're trying to figure out, are you trying to capture just the most contaminated portion of the plume, then clearly you do need to know what that vertical distribution is, and then clearly you need to have some approach to delineating vertically concentration, using, like I said, either multiple PRB depths or a MIPS probe or multiple screened wells.
Okay, and one final question, which I think I even know the answer to. Can you point to some good guidance and reference documents for capture zone analysis in fractured rock aquifer systems?
What's your answer, Linda?
No.
I don't know of one. Kathy is actually much more well-versed in these questions than I am. So, Kathy, do you know of one?
What would be helpful is the USGS has looked at water supply wells and looking at wellhead protection and in fractured rock environments in the Northeast. And although they're not capture zones per se from extraction wells remediating contaminated groundwater, the information is still applicable in terms of looking on a more regional aspect. So if you want to look under wellhead protection, I would Google it because I can't think of anything right off the top of my head. The USGS has publications, a couple of which I'm familiar with, or I can go look them up and provide them.
Yeah, certainly one of the things that's come up throughout these presentations is that a lot of people have that same question, and I think there is a need for a document similar to what we've discussed here to extend to those types of systems.
Right. It becomes much more difficult when the scale becomes smaller, more along the lines of our sites, to try and approximate the fracture distribution and flow.
Okay, and that's our last question. Thanks very much to both of our speakers for staying on and for great presentations. And again, I want to thank our audience and remind you that there is a feedback form, and please provide your feedback on any aspect of the seminar. This is our last offering of the seminar. We've had this four times, but there is an archived version, as I mentioned before, so if you want to hear it again or you want to refer someone to it, they can hear the audio and see the slides online, and that's found on the front page of the seminar. So thanks again, everyone, and this concludes our seminar. Mm-hmm.